911, what's your emergency?
Everybody, take cover.
All right, Ryan, that was great, but can we do it once more with even less feeling?
Now that was a two-take wonder,
now
I say.
Now that was a two-take wonder. Now that was a banger, I fear. Guys, welcome back to the First Risk podcast.
Welcome.
So back. Much has happened since we last recorded. Jane, has anything interesting happened in the world since we last recorded?
Not that I can recall.
I can't think of anything. You know what did happen? I saw that movie Twinless where Dylan O'Brien has the gay sex. I saw that.
Well, that's a pretty big deal. What did you think?
It was great. I thought that movie was excellent. It's one of my favorites of the year. It was very emotionally moving in ways that I will have to process for some time.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it. My friend adopted a new cat. So that was a pretty big world event.
Go cat. Go cat. We love kitty cats on this channel.
But other than that, I can't really think of anything big in the news.
I can't really think of anything else that's happening. How could I forget? The 911 season 9 promo dropped. Guys, what do we think?
I thought it was pretty good.
What do we think?
I'm joking. What annoyed me the most about this promo, which for anyone who hasn't seen it, consists of Maddie, Buck, Eddie, and Chimney sort of just like sedately standing in place while what appears to be either meteors or like chunks of cosmic debris fall from the sky. They're all just standing there with vaguely concerned looks on their faces. We're sort of slow zooming in on them as they each give like an NPC dialogue line. You've got Buck says like, "What the heck is that?" You go to Chimney, he's like, 118, brace for impact. You go to Eddie, he, you know, emotively as ever says, everybody take cover, even though he's completely alone. All of them are completely and desolately alone. It seems like
completely.
They filmed all of them separately, perhaps even on separate days, perhaps even in like separate countries and lifetimes for all we know, on a green screen, and then composited it together on this shared background. But, you know, we don't see any of them in the shot together. It looks very kind of isolating and disjointed and unsettling.
That's what it has to be, right? Because even just looking at, first of all, Maddie looks like she's running for president. And
yeah, she's got this very like kind of professionally grave posture and expression, and something about the
and
camera
she's,
work.
And she's wearing her like her regular like work outfit, and like she's at the beach, guys. I don't know how else to explain. She's at Santa Monica Pier, dressed like she's clocking to work in her blouse and her sweater. Like,
but something about like the visuals and her performance are, and it seems like it's, maybe I'm remembering incorrectly, but it seems like it's kind of a low angle shot, like making her look very powerful and in charge. And it really does look like some people have edited like an American flag in the background. It really does look like her like Obama hope poster.
It's so bizarre. I have to ask the question that I think, you know, is, you know, on everyone's first of all, oh, by
why
the way,
are we
I
still
just looked
watching
at it again.
This show?
Well, I just looked at it again, and what's funny is that when Maddie's looking up at the sky, like she's not even looking at the asteroids or whatever, they're behind her, or the space debris, they're behind her. And
she saw like a pretty cloud, she decided to focus on that.
Exactly.
She's like,
but it's a very somber
a
and introspective cloud. I guess the question that everyone's asking is, A, yeah, why are we still watching this? And B, oh, what was it? I completely forgot. What's the question everyone's asking? No, the question on everyone's lips. Guys, and leave a comment, of course. Do you think the actual season will play out in any way close to what Jane or I predicted? Because right now, and I'm so pleased to say, it's leaning in my direction.
No, it actually is. Like, no spoilers for our Patreon episode, but this promo does have the vibe of an alien attack is about to kill all of our main characters. Well, the big thing we haven't mentioned still is that this entire promo is set to a very interesting music choice. It's that show. I mean, it's that song, The Ordinary, by Alex Warren, which I had only heard of because I watched a Todd in the Shadows video about why it's bad. I find that song very, it's like Baby's first Imagine Dragons, right? It's like Imagine Dragons, but not even really as interesting as Imagine Dragons, which is a little sad.
Very low bar. A low bar. I mean, like, now, listen, I know I don't want to dip my toe too far into this arena because Jane just got dragged on Twitter for something kind of similar and innocuous.
Apparently, if you say you semi-irrationally dislike Gracie Abrams, a bunch of weird people will come out of the woodwork to tell you you're just a jealous harpy who wants to sleep with her boyfriend.
All I'm saying is that's so true. and she sings it just like that. So I had heard of Alex Warren specifically in promos for the VMAs where apparently he was performing. I can't imagine anyone actually watched his performance because I haven't seen a single clip of it online. This is the first Alex Warren song I ever heard, and I didn't know what to expect. Just by looking at him, I figured he would be like sort of a cheap Austin Mahone knockoff. Not to reveal how
there's
old
a name
I am
I haven't heard in a while.
Austin Mahone. And like watching this, I was just like, what the fuck is that in my ear? What are we doing? Oh. It's 911. So it actually felt kind of like a fitting choice for like the worst of this show. It just wasn't a great.
It wasn't a great way to kick it off. The situation at all, which is interesting because 911 is a show famous for having extremely unsubtle, like thematically relevant music choices. It's
That's true.
I understand, it's a song about the singer's like marriage or something. And also, I think it might be sneakily Christian in some way, but don't quote me on that. So I don't know. It just seems like an odd choice. And it's not even like a good song, like sonically. It's not, like I said, it just sounds like knockoff Imagine Dragons. It's not like a pleasantly sounding song. And I brought up on Twitter, like, remember the season 8 promo that was like, it was about the B-NATO and it had In the Air Tonight by Phil Collins, which I did complain about at the time because the show had already used that song in the season 3 premiere, and I was a little annoyed at what I perceived as a lack of knowledge of the show.
That's one of those complaints where you have to take a step back and like take yourself out of it.
Maybe I'm the problem. but I think that was a much better music choice for a promo, right? It's like relevant to what's happening. Mm-hmm. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek relevant to what's happening. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, mm-hmm. there are a bunch of fucking bees literally in the air tonight. Like, that's funny. This one, it's like, what can we even take away from this song being in it? And you might be thinking, why are we going in so hard on a promo that's not even like literally part of the show? It's just promotional material. They probably won't use that song in the actual episode. God forbid, right? And I guess it's just, it doesn't bode well to me, right? Like, to have such a low effort promo, that kind of says to me, I mean, that's what a promo is for, right? To get you excited about the season and to show you kind of a preview, to set the tone. Yes. And so personally, seeing such a low effort, kind of aesthetically tasteless promo makes me think that the season will be low effort and aesthetically tasteless. And I saw some annoying bitches on 911 Twitter trying to act all high and mighty about like, actually, if you're not into the camp and the like silliness of this show, you're watching the wrong show. It's like, no, listen, I am an expert. And it didn't used to be like this, okay? Like, the show used to be campy and silly and ridiculous and good.
If this was like the season 3 promo, they would have done like, and now the sky is falling down, down. That's what they would have done instead of this fuck ass song. So I'm totally on your side with this.
Yeah, and like, as much as I didn't end up loving season 8, at the beginning I was on board. Like, the B-NATO I think is pretty good, and the promotional material was good. And it's like, I know that the show can do the campy, ridiculous promo good, and this is not a good example of that. So like, miss me with that, like, you, like, I'm a bigger 911 fan than you because I like this ass promo. All that says to me is that you don't have taste, okay? And that's how Jane sees it. On that note, why don't we get into the episode, which is season 4, episode 1, the new abnormal. Okay.
Oh, Ryan Murphyverse. Okay.
This episode was directed by David Grossman, who also directed season 3, episode 12, Fools, which I cannot remember if we liked or not.
I do remember that they said fool like an unusual amount of times in that episode.
I remember that too.
And so it was like, it was quasi-stuck, it was quasi-trapped.
Is that the one where the guy swallows the fish by accident?
You said it was season 2, episode 12,
No,
Fools?
Season 3, episode 12.
Season 3, episode 12. Because I was about to say, I feel like we talked about that yesterday.
No, I feel like Fools was the one with the guy really swallowing scary. The fish. And I think we didn't like that one.
I think you specifically didn't like that call.
Yeah, that's true. But anyway, that's the director. I just thought it was nothing. Okay, it was nothing. This episode was written by Juan Carlos Cotto, our old friend.
Yes,
Also, the writers Nadia Abbas Madden and Taylor Wong are credited as staff writers for this episode. I still don't 100% know what that means, because it's like they don't credit every staff writer in every episode, so you would think maybe that means these two writers were particularly contributed a lot, but I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, listen, I've never worked in a TV writer's room. I don't know how it works. So I'm just going to say, yay, good for them. Credits.
Yay, good
credits,
for them.
Credits for everyone.
But we open
we,
with this
we begin this episode.
Title card.
We begin this episode.
That just
title
says card. September. And guess what song is playing in the background? It's September by Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Can we just say the meta trifold that is happening here? Because we
That's
are
true.
Currently in September, and
we
begin
in September.
In September. And what song is playing but September by Earth, Wind, and Fire?
Yeah.
This
is such a classic 911 music moment.
September.
They were like, okay, we're trying to communicate that it's September. So why don't we play the only famous, well, one of the only famous songs about September. I just remembered that Wake Me Up When September Ends exists.
Oh, I was just going to think about that. But that's like, but then that's like an anti-September song. It's like, oh, fuck this
True.
Month. Versus this song is like, oh my God, I love this month.
Yeah. Two opposite ends of the extreme, of the spectrum. But over
exactly.
this, we're getting like this radio DJ is kind of expositing that COVID infections are going down as more and more people are getting vaccinated. And during all this, we're seeing a woman exiting her house, putting on a mask, mm-hmm. and getting on her mm-hmm. bike, Ooh. Ready to face the world.
So, can I just say right off the bat, guys, I don't enjoy revisiting COVID era. I don't enjoy it. But I will say that that is my own personal thing. And I think that this is a good time capsule for that time. Mm-hmm. I don't like going dip back to that place, but I think it's done well in this episode, because I appreciate how not bullshitty this show is about masking, about, you know, social distancing and workplace safety, etc., versus this hellscape that we live in now, where this would be woke garbage and would be derided on Fox News.
Right.
So good for this diva for putting on her surgical mask. What mask did you have, by the way? What was your like go-to mask? I had two.
We had some fabric ones, and when I went back to college, I mostly only used surgical ones. I just didn't have a lot of N95s. Although I probably should have. Mm-hmm.
I had two masks. And I washed them religiously. I washed them like every day. I had a blue cloth mask, and that was like one of like the regular ones. And then I had this double sided mask that I got at this Japanese grocery store. It was like Hello Kitty, and it was lined on the inside. It was like a red mask. I loved that mask.
Oh,
so
you meant what pattern was
it.
On my mask? I think I had like a blue and white, like kind of cloud pattern one.
Oh, nice, nice. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what.
But
I
anyway,
was referring to.
Our biker passes a construction worker on the road, and we see that the construction worker is on the phone. He's like reassuring someone, like his girlfriend or wife or something. He's reassuring them about like microquakes. He's like, yeah, what you've been feeling, they're just microquakes. That's why we call them microquakes. Like, no big deal. The biker, back on her route, she kind of feels the earth move. There's a little bit of an earthquake.
Did you clock the shifting diegesis in this scene, where like it's like,
yes.
Oh, September's the background music, and then it goes into her headphones. It's like, oh, she's listening to September. See, I love
artsy.
those little moments, nice little filmmakery moments in this show. that sort of put you in the world. I wish the show still had those.
Suddenly, up ahead of her on the road, she sees a huge chunk of the Hollywood Reservoir Dam on the road in front of her, like this big block of like carved stone. She's like, that's not supposed to be there. She then sees a huge wave coming towards her. Sounds familiar.
She goes, it's right behind me, isn't it?
Yeah. She starts like pedaling. She says, Siri, call 911, which isn't even the first time the show has done that. There was that influencer call with the maggot in her face where she also said, Siri, call 911. She gets on the phone. She tells the dispatcher that the dam has broken. And then she's like, I'm not going to make it. And the water reaches her. And then it's the title card. And to their credit, I feel like they packed a lot into this first minute.
A lot. They packed a lot into it. You get the like the narrative beats with like the construction worker. You got the setup for her story. And also just I love the spectacle of her on a bicycle fleeing like a rush of like murderous water. And like it looked pretty good as far as like TV special effects go. So I was pretty impressed with this opening minute. It was a good way to get sucked into the season. It's like, oh, we're in for a banger. We're in for a banger this season. And then we go from the title card to 2 hours before the dam breaks.
A very classic 911 convention.
Maddie is doing a direct address to camera, right? Talking about how she misses caffeine. She misses caffeine. And then we do a reverse shot of Chim doing a direct address to camera. Oh. They're on Zoom. They're on Zoom debating on whether or not she can have coffee.
Maddie is like living at Chimney's place with Albert. Meanwhile, Chimney is staying with Buck. I feel like they don't really explain, I guess just because Chimney and Buck work together. They're sort of like quarantining together. But as everyone points out, you know, Eddie and Hen went back to their kids ages ago. There's really no reason Chimney should still be isolating himself from Maddie. Like they could just do the precautions like showering after work, whatever. But he's really, you know, Maddie's like the point of us moving in together was to live together. But Chimney is still seemingly too afraid of the risks.
And meanwhile, he's barking orders at Albert through the screen. Albert brings her a cup of peppermint tea, which sounded so good, by the way. Like, I'm considering like going out and just buying a box because I love peppermint tea. Mm-hmm. But then her nose, it's too powerful. She smells the coffee in his hand. She's like, that's not peppermint tea. Chim's like, don't you dare. He's like, I'll get you a coffee, ma'am.
Yeah. And Maddie rightly says, like, you know, the doctor said I can have like one cup a day. And Chimney's being a little bit of a micromanaging, you know, he's clearly very concerned about his future baby's health.
And then we find out Buck is pulling over COVID. Astronomical
supposedly,
game.
Supposedly.
Albert
basically
is,
what we hear
wanting
is
to
that Buck has been like having these little clandestine FaceTimes with someone and everybody thinks it's a girl that he's dating. And he kind of denies it, but, you know, they all think it's his new long distance girlfriend.
Albert's jealous, and I will say just the energy in this scene right off the bat, it was remarkably like different from like what we were getting, like sort of limping through the end of season 3. I feel like it sort of, as awful as that time period was, like incorporating COVID so heavily into the narrative kind of gave this show, and guys, I'm about to make a pun, so strap in. It kind of gave this show a bit of a booster shot. But booster in terms of energy, like, oh, the vibes are like, we're back. 911 is so back.
I do think.
And Maddie is so pregnant.
It definitely gave them some built-in conflict on kind of every level, right? So we're not saying COVID was good, but yes, in relation to 911, it does kind of give them some interesting things to work with.
What we're saying is we need a new COVID to save the show now.
except not the virus they brought in season 8, which killed off one of our beloved characters. I think a sign of their skill that they were able to weave it in a way that actually energized the show and not the opposite. Because like Grey's Anatomy did a COVID season too. I think all these mm-hmm. network shows kind of were under more pressure to incorporate COVID because like, unlike your average streaming show, they couldn't just like take some time off to wait for vaccines to be out. Like they had to get right back yeah. to business because like that's the nature of network shows. And so they kind of had no choice. You know, they had to have actors wearing masks and stuff. So they had to just mm-hmm. explain it in the narrative. And Grey's did a COVID season that I thought was pretty bad. A lot of the season is just Meredith like on the edge of death, having these visions where she's like talking to dead characters on a beach, which could have been interesting, but it's all really uninteresting. Like every episode, it'll be like, wow, she's talking to George on the beach. And like the sort of observations that these characters give her are just very, very bland, overdone, banal observations on life. Like they'll be like, love is the most important thing. And it's like, I didn't need an entire episode of Grey's Anatomy to impart that on me. So anyway, I think some shows did it better than others. And I think 9-1-1 did it pretty skillfully.
No, I totally agree. I was impressed by how well they weaved it into the narrative. And it was a sign of sort of resourcefulness on the writer's part. It's like, oh, they were paying attention. Like, oh, they yeah. actually had energy going into this. And
or they yeah,
like,
they sort of took okay, it let's... as a challenge and like an artistic yeah. limitation. And we're like, how can we mm-hmm. use this to make our characters' worlds more interesting?
And it was, and it's good. And as the episode goes on and like as the season goes on, you see more of that. And they incorporate it well into the individual character stories, but let's not get ahead of ourselves because Maddie, you know, she's saying that, you know, she wants coffee. Albert makes a joke about how maybe the baby like caffeine or maybe Chimney says that, wait, hold on. Let me gather my
It doesn't thoughts. Really matter.
It doesn't really matter. But she says a kind of a funny line because Chimney's like, the baby's the size of a mango. It doesn't get a vote. And then Maddie goes, the mango misses daddy. And mm-hmm. like, I've never heard a sentence like that before.
Yeah. And Jennifer but, Love Hewitt is forced to deliver it like fully earnestly.
Fully earnestly. We go from that to Athena at the Bethina household. Mm-hmm. She's inspecting her little badge because she's about to go to work. She's having, as Jamie Lee Curtis would say, trauma, rage
she's
and trauma,
flashbacks
rage
to her,
and trauma.
She's having flashbacks to her attack from the previous season. Suddenly Bobby comes in. He's like, they're on. And they go in the other room. We see Harry and Michael are on FaceTime. We get some exposition that Athena let Harry live with Michael during quarantine, which is kind of wild when we realize that David comes in. He officially has a name, Dr. McDreamy, Michael's boyfriend, who is a surgeon, right? A doctor. And is still going to work, is like about to go to work. I feel like it's kind of wild that Athena let Harry live with Michael during quarantine when Michael is living with like an essential worker who yeah. goes to the hospital every day and exposes himself to sick people. Well, doesn't like expose himself to sick people, but is
Whoa.
exposed
Whoa,
to
the
sick
twist.
People. David's a monster. No. Okay. Goes to work
McDreamy,
in the hospital
McNarly.
Every day and is around sick people every day, which I'm not saying obviously his job as a surgeon was very important. I'm just saying I feel like in real life, if you were the mother of a young child, you would be like, why don't you live with, well, I guess she's also a cop and is about to go back to work in person in this episode. Never mind.
Scratch and Bobby's that. Also a firefighter.
Yeah,
like, if anything,
so both
like,
households
you know,
are full of essential
Can we just, like, lean into the
be...
mic and say, like, you know, doctors who were on the front lines during COVID, you
Canceled.
Are awful for exposing 10-year-olds to, like, the pathogens.
And also
awful,
exposing
awful
yourself
people.
To sick people.
To sick people. Dr. McNarly, hello.
What do
you
to
think
that,
they,
that
it took them, do you think it took them all summer? Do you think it took them all break to come up with a name for this guy? They're yeah. just like sitting around brainstorming like, what are we going to call him? What
they
are we going
like,
to call him? No, that's been done.
They were like running market research, like what name would be the most appealing, holding test screenings of like they reshot the episode with like five different names for this guy.
And they ended up settling on David. And it's like, oh, two biblical names for these two guys in love. Wow. Groundbreaking. Michael and David. We're getting a little
it's
a little
Adam
you know,
and
religiosity.
Eve, not Michael. Michael
in here.
And David.
I'm always saying that. I'm always saying that.
But we hear that it's Athena's first day back at work. Michael thinks it's a little sudden, but Athena doesn't. You know, she says she's ready to come back. And she also, Michael mentions that, like, she's been growing an herb garden. Athena's like, I didn't tell you that. She basically realizes that Bobby and Michael have been, like, talking privately behind her back.
Yeah.
Bickle moment.
Off-screen Bickle moment.
Off-screen Bickle.
And so they quickly hang up.
Before they hang up, Michael asks about May's new job, which seems to annoy Athena. So
wait, okay, hold on. There's a very interesting piece of lore continuity happening here, which is that they seemed to stretch the timeline a little bit at the end of season three, because we saw May graduate, we saw her party, etc.
The entire summer,
In September, Athena says she's been off duty for 6 months. It's been 6 months of gardening and whatever. Did May graduate in March in canon is my question. Is that what happened?
She's a smart
kid.
Spring
she got break
into
is
USC.
In April.
Maybe she graduated early.
So they mention May's at her job, and we're like, oh, what's her job? And Athena hangs up, and we get this interesting, like, moment of, like, sort of like real world mentioned, where Bobby's like, it's been one thing after the another for the last 6 months with the virus and the protests and the fires.
And I also took note of this.
Okay, let's slow down there, Chief.
I did take. I was a little taken aback at, like, the kind of glibness of that summation of what had been happening in 2020. Like, yeah, interesting.
I was there, man. Like,
what were those protests about, Bobby? Did it have anything to do with your cop wife?
But we quickly run past that. I had to put my phone on silent because I just got a text. We go right by that. We breeze right by the virus.
Convenient, honestly, that Athena happened to be out of, like, not working while the 2020 protests were happening.
Oh my god. Could you imagine the way that this show would have, like, backbended to try and justify Athena's role?
Thank god that we didn't have to have that storyline.
Although we do circle back to CHOP, the Capitol Hill occupied protest.
But you know what?
I
don't think we have to deal with that until season 5. So right now, let's be blissfully ignorant. But yeah, Athena assures everyone that she's fine.
She sure does. And then we go to this accounting firm. Now, there's two people of note in this accounting firm, although more are in the building. There is a woman who is... is none too pleased, and there is a man who is chasing after her trying to explain himself, and it's like, okay, so she's about to wear his ass out, I hope. They find their little way into a conference room, and we sort of start to gather that there is this meeting that went down with a seemingly high power client, and as his superior, she was supposed to be present, and, you know, if they close a deal with the guy, you know, earn a sizable commission on this sort of thing. But instead, he went behind her back and roped in a seemingly young baby-faced intern named Jake, another man, to help deal with this old-timey pre-boomer client who just hates Zoom meetings. And I guess she was, you know, doing womanly things like...
Yeah,
you know,
hates Zoom meetings and also
boss.
Maybe hates women.
Yeah.
And then the conversation ends with this woman saying something like, you know, you threw me under the bus. And the guy says, I did not throw you under the bus. And then a giant bus crashes into the side of the building. That's a classic.
This show is so out of pocket. And I love it. And I can't explain to you guys how not on the ground floor they are. So it's like, what the fuck? How did this happen? Mm-hmm. But we won't find out immediately, because 1 hour before the dam, Hen and Bobby are at the firehouse gossiping about one Athena Grant. Bobby is concerned about, you know, Athena going back to work, and he's trying to like sort of be there for her every step of the way. And Hen sort of is the voice of reason here, like saying, listen, this is Athena's trauma. I can't stop saying it like Jamie Lee Curtis. It's just, it's so fun. Trauma. You know, she has to sort through this whole thing on her own, which is true, which is true. You know, and she mentions there's a reason why, you know, when Athena's out in the squad car, she's in the solo squad car. She doesn't have a partner. She's a sergeant. Right. She doesn't like to be dependent on anyone else. She's a very independent woman. It's a very quick scene of just them gossiping about her, as they often do. And we go to Athena at the police station, where Elaine Maynard, Captain Elaine Maynard, stands to greet her. Athena's wearing a mask. Maynard isn't. I don't know what that says about them, but let's get into it.
Yeah, Maynard, you know Maynard. I'm sorry. This is just our irrational. We've decided that Maynard is evil. And this was actually a big part of my season 9 plot. I feel like Maynard is one of those people who's like, well, the government says we have to wear masks, even though we all know that's fake.
Germ theory. You can't even see those. Like,
I've been taking ivermectin and I'm fine. So Athena comes into Maynard's office. They're kind of chatting about like, yeah, this is like such a weird new thing. I got to get familiar with all the new guidelines. And, Maynard asks if Athena's okay with not being out in the field. But Athena says she wants to ease back in. And we hear that Maynard was actually kind of surprised to get the call from Athena that she did want to come back to work at all. And Athena is like, you know, I'm not throwing in the towel just yet. And Maynard's like, well, I kind of wouldn't have been surprised if like you had decided to. Athena's like, you sound like my daughter. So Maynard is like, how is May? And Athena's like, you know, May's
dialogue is so natural. I love it.
You know, one thing to the next. Yes, Athena says May's actually taking a gap year before going to USC. And Maynard's like, you don't seem that happy about that. Athena says it's more about what she's doing to fill that gap. Cut to, May is a dispatcher now. She's a 911 dispatcher.
Guys, all-time banger storyline alert.
No, like this was
May
such a
Grant
smart decision.
Is at the dispatch.
So smart.
It was
it, like,
such
brings
a smart
some,
decision.
It brings May into a leading role in a pretty natural way. Mm-hmm. And it also brings like some young blood into the dispatch. We've got like a new young first responder, essentially, which
without
we
feeling
had
like Scrappy Doo-ish, you know,
no,
without
yeah,
feeling Scrappy Doo-ish.
This is like an established character and somebody with pre-established connections to our other characters.
Yeah, exactly. And you get to see her interacting with Maddie. You'll get to see her interact with Josh and with Eddie later on. No spoilers. And so, yeah, May, she's taking her gap year. She's working dispatch. And she, we find her practicing answering calls, doing her 911 dispatcher voice.
Which, like,
I
low
will
key,
say,
we would all do this. Yeah. If
we would
in this
all
job.
Do this. I have to, like, warm up to, like, do our opening stinger when I'm the dispatcher. And, like, I feel like I'm bad at it.
Yeah. So Maddie comes up and she's like, are you practicing calls? She's like, I'm trying to get the voice perfect, whatever. We see that May is, like, very eager to please. She's very eager to be kind of like a good student of the 911 dispatch center, which Maddie asks her, like, are you sure you'd not rather be in college right now? But May points out that college right now would be just staring at a screen anyway. So she kind of might as well do it while answering 911 calls. And to kind of get her more involved, Maddie decides to do an exercise where Maddie will answer the phones while May, like, does the typing part of taking 911 calls.
But she presents this in the funniest way.
Yes.
She says, it's duet day. I'm going to be lead singer and you're going to play the keyboards. And May's like,
yeah, May just kind of looks at her like, okay, grandma, let's get you to bed.
I love them. I love this duo. And I'm so excited to see so much more of them. I will say I also enjoy keeping up the tradition of new dispatch people just getting thrown to the fucking wolves, like on their first day on the job.
On their first day.
I wanted May to have a help is not coming moment. I'm not gonna lie.
Right. I but she's saying it to her own mom.
You know what I wanted? I wanted like a moment, like in the first, like the pilot of Grey's, where like Meredith, like someone dies and Meredith walks outside and she throws up outside. And Christina goes after her.
Iconic.
And then she goes, "If you tell anyone," and then she walks back inside. I would have loved something like that. But it's okay. What we get is still good. Because we go back to the construction worker guy, and he's talking about the little itty bitty quakes, and to his girl, and his mm-hmm. boss calls, and we sort of get this interesting sort of like competing shots thing where we see mm-hmm. him like talk to his boss, and then we go to. Okay, I love this kid so much. His name is CJ. He rolls up to the bus and he greets the bus driver. And this kid, so it's like immediately apparent this kid is like on the spectrum. He mentions he's going to a special education class and he's working on his eye contact. He's immediately like very warm and friendly with the bus driver. There's a familiarity. He even mm-hmm. throws a little shade because she says, "Oh, you're a senior this year." And he goes, "Yeah, like you." And she goes, "Ooh, not too much. Now, not too much, CJ."
We do like CJ. However, what do we think about this depiction of an autistic kid?
I'm like of two minds of it because like it is very in line with like Hollywood conventional portrayals of autism.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like I've also definitely met people like this, who like present in this way, and like I don't think it's necessarily an inaccurate depiction. I just think it's a common depiction. But I'm not opposed to it, and I thought that the character himself was very charming and had a lot of agency in the narrative, which I appreciated. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just like this kid's autistic and isn't that sad/adorable.
Aww. Yeah,
you know, that's fair. Like you felt like a real person.
I guess at times I found it like a little, I don't know if the word is like ham-fisted or just like laying it on thick to try and remind the dumb audience that like this is an autistic character, or like over explain maybe. But at the same time, it is like a network show. So I guess
yeah.
It's just kind of in line
this
with what they
this
do.
Portrayal of autism was not nuanced enough for my 911.
You know, I'm used to the 911 that's really subtle, especially when it comes to like characters and their mental states and mm-hmm. yeah. Okay, you got
He should have been following a hyperfixation and walked throat first into a pole.
I mostly thought it was good. But yes, he meets this lady on the bus, another bus patron. Mm-hmm. They say mm-hmm. hi, and then suddenly this other guy gets on the bus, and he's like not someone who knows these people. He sits in the priority seating. It's a mostly empty bus, so he just gets in the priority seating that you're supposed to give up if mm-hmm. there's like a mobility challenged or like elderly or pregnant person who wants to sit in those seats. But there's nobody yeah. else around. So like, he's fine. That's what we get for now. We go back to the construction guy talking to his boss on the phone. He's like, "I'll take a look at the dam. I'll call you back." Back on the bus, our CJ is getting very bothered by the guy sitting in the priority seating, and
he's breaking the rules.
He's
okay.
breaking CJ's idea of like what order on the bus is supposed to look like, and so his way of telling him that he's uncomfortable with that is to start kind of reciting this thing from like the bus policy, right? Saying like the priority mm-hmm. seating is reserved for mobility challenged and elderly passengers. The guy who's a little grumpy seeming says like, "If someone gets on, I'll move." And then the woman who's friends with CJ says, this is a part I objected to a little. She says, "CJ here is very special." Like, okay, girl.
That was very condescending. Okay,
very
girl.
Very special. And, you know, likes everyone to sit in their specific spots. And I will say, as much as I get CJ here and I empathize with him, I was also empathizing a lot with this guy. I hate to say it. I think he's supposed to seem
too.
Like
no,
I think
I
he's
get
supposed
it.
To seem like a big, you know, dumb villain. But, you know, he explains that he's been unemployed because of the pandemic and he's looking for work. And, you know, we can see that he's grumpy. He's not really down to have this conversation. He says, mm-hmm. like, why don't I just mind my business and you mind yours? And it's like, it's a complicated thing because, like, in most situations, it's like CJ is not like, it's there's nothing forcing this guy to move, right? The guy is right.
Yeah.
That he, you know, the people are allowed to sit in those seats if nobody actively needs them. And
yeah.
But also, I think if this were a real world situation, it's like, it's an empty bus. There are plenty of other seats, and it's clearly upsetting this kid, and it would clearly make him feel better if you just got up, so you probably should. But I also understand why this guy who's already in a bad mood, like, yeah, it's true that he doesn't have to get up, and this could be perceived, especially with, like, the other passenger kind of teaming up with CJ, it could be perceived as, like, why are these people just, like, harassing me over this thing that's not a big deal?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that, and I kind of want to do, like, a self-investigation for, like, myself. Like, I want to do a little woke check for me, just because, like, as we're talking, I'm finding myself asking this question to me of, like, how much of my sort of, like, affection for this kid and appreciation for this scenario and, like, sort of, like, partialism to him is, like, predicated on the fact that he is a kid. Like, if he was an adult, like, 25, 30, 35, doing the same thing, would I have the same impulse? And I don't know. I actually don't know. Because it is a different, it shouldn't be a different conversation when it's an adult, but, like, I don't know, I'm thinking to myself, like, as, and I'm saying this as someone who's on the spectrum myself, not to say that I'm the end all be all in this, I'm approaching this with
Ryan
curiosity.
Ryan is the end all be all of people on the spectrum, and he does.
I'm the autism gatekeeper, and you will all bow down to me. I'm the final authority on this.
I don't think it's necessarily unfair to give someone more leeway if they're a kid, even if they are also on the spectrum, right? Like, I think we can still assume an extra level of, like, I don't know, naivete or immaturity from just being underage. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think either of them is, like, in the right or in the wrong. It's just, like, you know, CJ's not technically right, but it's just a pretty simple thing that would make him feel better. So in real life, yeah, I would probably just move. If anything, just on a selfish level, you're like, well, I know this kid will probably stop, you know, talking to me or stop yelling at me if I just move, right? Like, it'll make the situation kind of easier for everyone. But if it's, like, on an empathetic level, you're like, it'll make him feel better if I move. But obviously this guy is just feeling like, you know, I'm not up for this today. Like, I just want to mind my business. I sat down. I don't want to move.
Yeah, I'm just curious to my own biases here, because I guess I am partial to CJ in the scenario, and I guess it is because he's younger, and I have more of a built-in tolerance for that. So I guess I just need to do an implicit bias check later.
You just hate
the ageism, the intersection of ageism and ableism. It's strange. It's a strange thing to come up against in these conversations. But yeah, that's interesting.
The tension's
gathering, and there's a small earthquake that happens. Guys, the dam is about to go bye-bye.
Well, we see, like, the 118 notices the little earthquake. It's like one of those ones that's, like, not big enough to, it's like big enough to feel, but not big enough to really mess anything up. So the 118 notices, they're kind of chatting about, like, what magnitude do you think that was? Buck is, like, leaning against the fire truck in this really interesting way on his phone, looking at the numbers. At dispatch, Josh comes out and tells everybody to prepare for the deluge of calls they're about to get, because, you know, people will feel this earthquake. They'll start calling it in. We then see the construction worker. Uh-oh. What may have been a small earthquake for everyone else was, like, the final straw that cracked the dam, and it breaks. So that's not good.
He got fucked up. Guys, this guy, talk about a deluge. This guy got swept away. Okay, he got swept away.
Come to think of it, I don't think we ever see what became of him. Maybe we will in the next episode. I don't remember. But for all we know, this guy is just, like, dead as fuck.
No, I have to be so sure that he's dead as fuck. Are you kidding me? All the force of that rushing water. If he's not blood and bones at this point, then he's Superman. Like,
well, I don't know. I think I could probably survive it.
Oh, right. I'm sure.
You know,
but,
ripped to him, but who, different.
But hey, listen, who should get the call from the lady on the bike?
It's Linda. Okay, Linda Bates of the 911 dispatch. She gets the call from the biker from the beginning of the episode about the dam having broken. You know, she hears the woman scream. The call cuts out. Josh kind of comes over and investigates. On the bus, CJ is getting more and more agitated because the guy is like standing his ground. The friend of CJ starts kind of chewing out the grumpy guy. She's like, you know, it's, you can just move, whatever. CJ and the other passengers, all of a sudden they see the giant wave approaching. I was kind of noticing throughout this episode, it's kind of funny how, like, obviously it's not a tsunami, it's a different emergency, but it is funny that the season again opens with a giant wave coming for everyone.
And to you, like a wave too.
Yeah.
Electric boogaloo.
For good. The wave, they see the wave approaching, and the grumpy guy suddenly, you know, his grumpiness is replaced by awe and panic. He says, "Holy Mother of God," a phrase which will never be important on this show again. The wave hits the bus.
Thank God.
And sends it right into the building, which brings us to where we are now with a bus sticking out the side of a building.
We should clarify something tactical here. It didn't shoot the bus up like five stories. They're on an elevated freeway. And the building was right next to it. So that's important context. I was a little curious why like a high powered accounting firm would build their high rise right next to an elevated freeway. I feel like maybe it just, I don't know, I feel like that cheapens the real estate a little bit. So if they had like a meeting in the conference room and the freeway was like right in their periphery, then that wouldn't be like ideal for investors or something. I don't know.
Well, I feel like everything's next to the freeway. One of those LA snobs in our comments is going to be like, you guys don't know what LA is actually like. And that is true. But I associate from the one time I went there, like, it's just like cars and roads everywhere. So
everywhere,
I wouldn't be
surprised.
And, you know, there's so much driving involved. I wouldn't be surprised if there was like a decent real estate high rise, and also it happens to be right next to a freeway.
Yeah, but the 118 responds, and Chimney, and they're all looking up at the bus wedged into the side of the building, and Chimney just goes, "That does not go there." And I'm like, "Well, you see, on this day, it actually does." Josh,
who are you, Chimney, to decide what does and does not go anywhere?
Thank you. The whole call, the whole scenario with like the woman and the guy in the accounting firm, like mansplaining was mentioned. Like, it is clear he was being a pig-headed piece of shit, and now Chimney is over here mansplaining to us, the audience, that buses aren't meant to go into the side of buildings.
Do buses have borders? Do buildings have borders? Well, kind of.
I guess they have walls. But back at dispatch. At dispatch. This episode's moving really fast. Josh is running shit like the Navy. Mm-hmm. Where is Sue Blevins? No one knows. Josh is the new Sue.
Josh is the new Sue. Yes.
Duet Day is canceled. No one tell the Glee Club. Duet Day is canceled. Okay.
Josh
because
directs
May
to tune into as many calls as she can, like overhear calls to map out which streets are flooded, which is kind of a smart idea. Suddenly everybody gets distracted. Josh, May, and Maddie gather around the TV to look at the coverage of this bus crash on the news. And, you know, it's something like, you know, first responders are racing to the scene right now. And then we do this like comedy cut to the 118, just like calmly going up the elevator to the top of the building, which I would think that if a bus crashed into a building, it would not necessarily be safe to use the elevator. Like, you know, when a building's on fire, they say don't use the elevator. I would think if anything that structurally damaging happened to a building, you probably don't want to get on the elevator. This is basically the premise of the Charlie Sheen movie 9/11, which you'd think would be about like, you know, it is about people at Ground Zero, but it's specifically about a bunch of people in an elevator on 9/11 in the World Trade Center.
Listen, not to mansplain this too hard, but there's a structural difference between a Boeing 737 and a semi-slow moving bus crashing into a
bus
building.
Bus fuel can't melt steel beams.
We're always saying this. And we find out later that indeed it cannot. It can't even melt firefighter turnips.
Bobby Nash.
Bobby Nash would never die until he met the super virus made by the evil scientist lady.
In the elevator, Buck is on his damn phone and he's researching, on Wikipedia, how big the Hollywood Reservoir is. And he's like, damn, that's a lot of like gallons of water. Hen says her mom once survived a dam break, like back in the day, and it's kind of okay because water only ever wants to go in one direction, out to sea.
And that's what makes it beautiful.
I love that we had the same thought at the same time. Eddie says to Buck, because everybody gets out of the elevator and it's presumed that Eddie and Buck will go up to the top of the building together to like secure the bus.
And make out on the way, of course.
You read my mind. Eddie says to Buck, at least it's not a tsunami, right? And then the elevator doors close on them. And then I wrote in my notes, and then they kissed, but it was off screen, and so we didn't see it. So I like that, again, we had the same thought.
Mm-hmm. And we get to the 118, like, you know, going into the conference room, making their way. There's a bus in there. It's crazy. The woman, whose name is Ashley, they find her on the ground. She's okay. She's actually chilling, okay?
Like, what is she even
She's got blown
about?
Back by the impact. Like nothing, right? But Chimney, he delivers another very funny line where he says to her, this is about to be the understatement of the century, but there's been an accident. I love him. I missed him on our break. I miss Chimney.
At least he's still on the show. At least we can, maybe that's how we should approach season 9, is we should just watch only for Chimney.
Yeah, like how I'm going to watch Nashville, but only for Leanne Rimes. Exactly.
You're going to watch Nashville?
I feel like I have to.
Don't. Maybe I'll pirate
Dr. Arizona's it. On it. it. Yeah, no, I would pirate it. I wouldn't watch it live, certainly.
Anyway,
but the bus
the
is okay.
Tells the
no,
bus
okay.
Passengers.
So here's the thing: the guys on the bus are panicking, okay? Because how could you not? And as they're like sort of rushing to try and get off the bus, they're shifting it. It could fall. They could all die, which would be bad. So Buck is up on the roof doing some bullshit, like the skinny little bitch that he is. Okay, so Eddie has the winch. Bobby explains, I got guys on the roof that are going to stabilize this. Eddie has a little winch, and Buck is going to go over the side of the building because he always likes to just do stuff like that. I'm sure I've never been more sure in my entire life that someone has gone skydiving. And they start to do some triage on the bus. They, you know, start gathering information. The bus driver, who we love the bus driver. She is pinned against it because there's a little support beam pinning her to her seat. And this actress, she's like a day player and she is selling like the pain and like the terror of the situation. I was like, my heart was breaking for her. I'm like, no, please let her be okay. CJ is traumatized.
Mm-hmm. He's a little stressed because his friend, the woman, is unresponsive on the ground. She's passed out.
Yeah.
Grumpy guy.
It's pink
has a
apron
shard
day.
Of glass
it's pink apron
his...
day. Okay.
Right. Grumpy guy has a shard of glass in his leg, and like a dumbass, he just pulls it right out in a panic, causing ephemeral bleed. CJ, a quote, proud Aspie and wilderness ranger, creates a makeshift tourniquet for him out of his belt.
Mm-hmm. King. I love CJ.
Pretty resourceful. Meanwhile, Buck is like rappelling down to the bus, and he has this line where he says something about like, you know, the natural gas in this situation is taken care of. It won't explode. So that's good.
It's like, how do you know that?
Yeah, literally.
Who told you that? Who told you that?
No, I kind of missed, like, in the line, he says something about, like, this means that the natural gas is okay. Like, I didn't even really catch what he thought was making it so that the natural gas wouldn't blow up. But clearly it was.
I didn't either.
He did misjudge the situation because of what will happen later. But anyway, CJ's friend starts to wake up, and Buddy successfully secure the bus. But Buck gets back down to where the bus is and he finds the male employee, the like sexist employee, under the bus. He has been literally thrown under the bus. Chimney like checks him out. He's alive, but they're like not sure how they can get this bus out of the wall with this guy underneath.
And so the bus shifts. He screams. He's like he wakes up and stuff. And he confesses that, like, he purposefully kept her out of the meeting because that pre-boomer weirdy didn't want a woman touching his money, because I guess she would run off with it and buy clothes, women, right?
Shoes, and lipstick perhaps.
And as the bus shifts, and he screams like he's getting the best head of his life. Bobby realizes that the bus is a seesaw,
also known as a teeter totter.
What did he mean when he said that, by the way? Oh, a teeter totter, like it's gonna teeter totter and fall.
A teeter totter is like a regional variation of, some people call a seesaw a teeter totter.
Okay, but why would he say that? Why would he say that in this moment?
So I think we can just assume that Chimney grew up calling it a teeter totter. And Bobby grew
But there's other stuff they have to take care of. It's like if we were pinned under a merry-go-round and we had started having a semantic debate.
I would be like, by the way, this is called a carousel.
And then I would scream that it's like a merry-go-round, and then it would dig into my sides and I'd start bleeding out.
See, now this may not have happened in real life, but it would make a great 911 scenario, right?
Oh, you're right. We would be a great call on this show. That should be a Patreon episode.
I know
episode,
we've
just
kind of antagonized you for the entire time we've been doing this podcast, but if you ever want us to cameo, we could do a great like meta cameo where we're in a 911 scenario and we're arguing over something extremely trivial, but we're acting like it's like the biggest deal in the world, like we like to do on this show.
Talk to our agents. I don't our agents,
it's me,
are
I'm
us.
The agent.
I'm the agent. I'm a professional agent for myself. So they start doing like proper triage. They get the guys out, they get the shifty guy out, they secure tourniquet on his leg, they get the bus driver
medical
out.
School foreshadowing. Ooh. Here where like, ooh, she starts running triage and she is immediately like so on it and like doing all this stuff running the show, which obviously like she probably would have done before, but it feels like a little nod to like remember that Hen is like getting more involved in her medical career.
Love to see that. And they go to the woman in pink, the lady in pink. Her name is Tracy. And Hen starts inspecting her. She asks her,
thanks CJ for saving his life. And then they get him off the bus.
Oh,
so
that is important.
The
conflict is resolved. Autism rights. Hen is inspecting this woman. She's like, you know, talking to her. She goes, Tracy, do you know what year it is? And she goes, don't make me say it out loud. I'm like, girl, I get it. We were all there.
Imagine if like she's actually more out of it than she seems. And what she meant is like, it's 1919. I don't know.
I don't want to say it. I'm embarrassed.
She's like, don't make me say it. 1776.
Sheepishly like puts fingers together like, oh, I don't know. And then she breaks out the little mini flashlight and inspects her eye. Her right pupil is fucking dilated as shit. Oh, I should say that she has kind of like a concave, like sort of skull moment because she hit her head really hard. Oof. And her right pupil is dilated as shit. She apparently has like an interesting kind of like cerebral hernia, which means that if she's not in surgery in the next 20 minutes.
Was it a hernia? I thought she just had like a brain bleed or something.
Well, she's going to start pushing her brain out of her eye.
That
is
true. Hen did say that, which I haven't heard of that before, but don't like to contemplate it. Yeah.
There's a
Grey's
episode.
Yes. Either way, this lady's got a pretty severe head injury. And Hen is like, we need to get her off the bus. Specifically, we need to like tilt her head at 30 degrees. And, you know, we can't get her, like, this situation in her head could be messed up if we don't get her out exactly at 30 degrees. So Buck gets on that, and Bobby's trying to get CJ out, but CJ's, like, too freaked out by his friend's dire situation. So Buck and Eddie, like, get the friend out, and Bobby's like, you know, you guys, like, get out, I'll deal with this. And CJ's too freaked to exit. Bobby tells Eddie.
We skipped ahead a little bit because Chimney is with Ashley outside of the bus because they're monitoring Keith's position.
Keith is the guy who's under the bus.
Status. Keith is the guy who got thrown under the bus hard. He stopped talking, which is apparently unusual for him. And so it's like, oh no, he's gonna die. They gotta do this. They gotta do it now. So Bobby's like, okay, Eddie, on my mark. And Buck's like, Bobby, you gotta get off the bus first. And he's like, just trust me. And then he's sort of like, he's relating to CJ. He's like sort of meeting him at his level. He holds out his hand and CJ takes it. And Bobby tells Eddie to do it. And he grabs onto one of the poles and then Eddie does it. He tilts the bus back. Bobby holds CJ steady and they pull Keith out. They got him. They got everyone out of this ridiculous scenario. But the drama is not over yet because after they do that, first of all, Ashley says that she's still not giving Keith any of her commissions.
They kind of negotiate.
Keith asks for like
50-50,
70-30, whatever. It's like this guy's, you know, on death's door over here.
But Eddie brings the bus back up, and suddenly natural gas started leaking, despite Buck's line earlier. Again, I don't really know what happened here. It doesn't matter, no. But what matters is...
Do buses have natural... Okay.
Maybe it's natural gas from the building. Like, you know, maybe they, like, disturbed a pipe when the fucking bus drove into it.
I think I just don't know how buses work.
Or buildings or natural gas. I'm right there with you. But whatever.
Exactly.
The point is the bus is going to explode. Okay, the bus is going to explode. Yeah. Bobby and CJ are preparing to get off the bus, but then it does explode. It just fucking explodes. And it's such a huge explosion. And you're looking at it and you're like, there's no way anyone survived that. They have like done the effect to look like a 100% lethal explosion. But somehow... Yeah. When a terrified Buck gets onto the just exploded bus, he finds Bobby and CJ without a scratch on them. Like, Bobby had kind of jumped on CJ to shield him. Like, Bobby doesn't even have, like, singed eyebrows or anything. It's like, how did this happen? You know, how did you survive this fiery explosion?
Do you want to know why he survived? And I'll give you a short, sweet, one-word answer. Realism.
Oh, of course.
Realism, baby.
Yeah,
he had
that
to survive
makes sense.
For realism. Yeah.
You're right.
And so I guess CJ's fine. Bobby's fine. Everyone lives. Everyone goes home. School's out. Fuck 12. Speaking of, guess where we are? We get a shot of Beverly Hills. That's where I wanna be.
We hear like scattered 911 calls coming in, and then we see Athena at the station. Mm-hmm. She's on the phone just kind of fielding logistics of this disaster. She's like directing where to put a reunification center. Maynard comes in. She says she got an alarming call from the emergency operations center that there might be a landslide coming. Cue the Stevie Nicks song. Yeah. There might be a landslide coming east of the reservoir, which is a residential area. I think it's basically supposed to be like right in the Hollywood Hills. Maynard says that they'll need someone on the ground to kind of supervise the scene of like the evacuation of this residential neighborhood. And she wants Athena to do it. She's like, guess what? It's time to get back out there because, like, we need hands. So elsewhere, Maddie gets a 911 call. It's Biker Lady. She's back. She's trapped somewhere underground. Trapped in.
We should say a Mario Bros. Ass pipe. Okay. Cue the.
She's
fucking
in like a big tunnel underground.
Da-na-na-na-na.
But she does refer to it as a pipe, which does feel pretty Mario coded.
Mm-hmm. Look for a mushroom, Janelle. You'll be feeling fine in no time.
Josh comes over to Maddie, and they think this woman's stuck in some kind of storm drain.
Because they have her like look around for like markings on the walls, etc., and she sees SW, and so it's like, oh, it's like a
Star Wars. It was a
spillway. That's the word, spillway.
Yeah. But they realize that this lady's, they don't know exactly where she is, and they do know that she's underground. And said ground, at least if she's in LA, like this ground is potentially about to be washed away in a mudslide, which would bury her alive. So that's a problem, right? Yeah. But then we
In other words, the landslide is going to bring her down.
It's going to bring her down. But then we go to 6 months before the dam break. We see this woman living her regular idyllic life with her biker husband. Her biker husband like comes back from a ride. You know, their life is great. Mm-hmm. She suddenly gets a ping on her phone that there's a shelter in place order. They're like, for how long? We go through the months, you know, like March, mm-hmm. April, whatever. We see her like ordering groceries, stocking up on cleaning supplies. And kind of as the months go by, we see the deliveries getting like more and more remote. Like it starts out right at her door. Then it turns into like curbside, you know, just leaving it at the curb. One day, her husband comes back from a bike ride and he collapses. He's like had a heart attack or something. We see her calling the hospital and clearly receiving the news that he's died. This is crazy. This is like the montage at the beginning of the movie Up is basically what this sequence
is. No, it genuinely is.
It's a lot like that.
And it has like a sort of a similar sort of like somber score and tone like throughout the whole thing.
The sort of like melancholy score.
Yeah. She calls her mom, like the color grading is very like gray. And her mom's like, how are you doing? She's like, I'm fine. I guess I'm not fine. I don't want you traveling. It's whatever. My husband's dead. So here's the twist. Janelle was not a career cyclist. She was not a lifetime lover of the bicycle. She started cycling.
Shout out to my Patreon tier lifetime lovers.
Shout out to Janelle for getting into cycling to honor the memory of her dead husband, whose personality seemed to be just bike.
His job is bike. And she kind of says to her mom on the phone, she says, like, I haven't left the house. Where would I go? And then she sees her husband's bike outside and gets this idea.
And so, like, let's tally off the bodies here. Cycling conspired with coronavirus to kill her husband. And then the cycling put her in peril just as a dam broke and swept her away to places unknown. So maybe cycling has to go. I'm calling for a complete shutdown of recreational cycling in the U.S. until we figure out what's going on.
I support this because I don't really like biking. But we see her order a bike. She assembles it. And then we go back to September because she's going out.
The 21st night.
She's going out for her first ride, which this is. Yeah, I had also like.
Oh wait, hold on. I think you did a Taylor Swift reference, and I did the Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah, you didn't get it. It's okay.
I go back to September every time.
Back to December in the song, so I can understand why you wouldn't have been there. Anyway, she goes out for her first ride, and yeah, I also took note of this. Like, this is crazy that this was her first ride, and this happens. Like, that's just bad luck. We see the dam break scenario again from the beginning of the episode. Back in the present, she's telling Maddie over the phone about how she took up cycling after she lost her cyclist husband to COVID. Josh brings up a map of the city's spillways. They're like trying to pinpoint where this lady could be. Maddie asks if she can like get to a nearby like circuit box or something, but it's locked. And Maddie suggests using like some of her bike repair tools to try and smash the lock open. But it doesn't really work on the first few attempts, and she starts
to give
up.
She's a wimp. No, Janelle is a wimp, okay? She's barely even tried. Getting her grieving, mourning, like, over her dead husband, like, as she's, like you know, impotently hitting the lock. And it's like, girl, get over it. Come on. Maddie's over here like, you're not going to be alone forever. We're still here. I'm still here. And I'm like, yes, we are still here. Where's your rage, Janelle? Where's your fucking anger at what the world has taken from you? And she finds it. And she takes the repair tools in her hands. And she strikes the lock. And she screams as she strikes the lock until finally it breaks. And she presses the button and the spillway opens. And they identify her. And guys, she's been at the beach this whole time. She could have just been chilling.
She was low-key not in... Well, we don't know that she was in no danger. Like, I don't know, maybe... Well, no. I was going to say maybe the water would have filled up in the spillway, but no, because it was just... It would have just rushed out to... I don't know. Whatever. she wasn't where they thought she might have been. Like, they were worried that she might be in the path of the landslide. She was not. She was like, yeah, out near the water. And so as the paramedics are rescuing her, she has like a funny little line to end the sequence where she says, why do I smell the ocean? And it's like, girl, because you were at the ocean. So think about that.
So think about that. Think about that next time you put yourself in harm's way, Janelle. Yeah. No, I'm off cycling. I don't think it's the cycling's fault. I'm blaming it all on Janelle.
Oh, Janelle's had a hard year.
She's had a hard year. We all had a hard year, Janelle. You're not special.
Jeez. Well, Athena.
Take it in stride like CJ.
Athena's in the hills. She pulls up to a house, a mansion, really, in the path of the potential landslide. There are some cops already there. They greet her. They're like, hey, welcome back to work or whatever. And she's like, couldn't let you puppies get into trouble. There's like a prolonged like dog metaphor she's using.
I was not fond of it. I'm not going to lie.
Throughout the extent, no, it's a little weird. I was not fond of this. She's like, I couldn't let you puppies off the leash. It's like, okay, well, they're grown men.
Do they need the mask? Should we put them in the pup mask? Like,
okay, well, they have a little exchange. The cops tell her that the resident of this one house won't answer the door. Like, they know someone's in there, but none of the neighbors really, like, know much about her, and she won't answer. So Athena says, like, you guys go finish the job. Not, like, finish the job. Finish evacuating the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. She'll stay and handle this house while they leave. So she knocks at the door. There's no answer. But she sees a woman, like, peering at her through the window. So she's like, okay, I know you're home. Like, open up. And this,
I guess that's
wealthy,
probable cause.
This wealthy looking woman opens the door, you know, like very made up, nice jewelry outfit. Athena tells her about the evacuation order. And this lady's like, oh, yeah, like I heard it. I was just getting ready to leave. Like, you can go ahead and leave me and I'll be right there. Right. And she tries to shut the door, but Athena stops her. Athena comes in, which, yeah, this whole sequence, I was like, I get that it's an evacuation order, but, like, is she allowed to just, like, barge into the woman's home? I don't really know about...
has that ever stopped her in the past, is my
question.
No,
but I was just wondering, like, from a legal perspective, like, does the evacuation order mean that Athena gets to forego all the usual stuff and can just barge in? I don't really know. She seems to believe that she
has
that authority.
In the world I'm living in.
Right. So Athena barges in. She says, well, I have to make sure you're not under any duress, like being forced to stay here. She says she didn't notice a car outside. So, like, how's this lady planning to leave? She starts bullshitting. She's like, yeah, I'm getting a ride from a neighbor. And Athena, kind of out of pocket, is like, well, none of your neighbors seem to know you. You don't have any friends. Athena looks around. She starts asking this lady about herself.
No friends, no plans, no bags packed. Flop, chop. Girl, it's over.
Athena asks her about herself. She says she's a medical consultant and she works from home like everybody else right now. And she tries to tell Athena to leave, but Athena stays, potentially illegally, right. Who knows, and demands that this woman get ready to leave. But she notices that the woman's shoes seem unworn. She's like, have these even been used? Mm-hmm. And she kind of starts to realize, and she says, like, when's the last time you went outside? And this woman says, I can't leave. I'll have a panic attack. I'll freak out. I'll hyperventilate. I can't leave. Athena asks how long it's been. This woman says it's been 7 years since she's left the house. She's agoraphobic, we're gathering. And she says,
like she's
it's
the
not
author
safe
character in that movie, Nim's Island. Did anyone see Nim's Island back in the day? Like,
I think
the,
they
like the
made
main
us
character?
Watch it on the bus on like an elementary school trip. But
oh,
I remember
it was very much one of those movies. Well, the main character or one of the main characters. I think it was the Jodie Foster character that she was an agoraphobic author who hadn't left her house in years. And she had to go on this island adventure to save the girl. I don't remember anything about
Abigail
the plot
Breslin,
of that movie. I just remember that was the character.
That's
what
like
I always like jump to
about
with,
that
like,
movie. I remember that it had kind of a circular, like, I remember that the opening and closing narration, it's kind of a full circle moment. And that's all I remember about that movie.
You remember the beginning when it started and the end because it was over. You hated
it. My apologies
it.
to the writers and directors, potentially, I don't know who fucking did it, of Nim's Island.
They made a sequel to that movie, by
did
the way.
They?
They made a second one. They made a second Nim's Island. And do you know who starred in it?
Who?
They didn't get the girl. They replaced her with fucking Bindi Irwin.
Well, that's not a bad... that's still pretty good.
No, it's a good choice, like as far as, like, you know, like, it fits her because her whole thing is like being adventurous and outdoorsy, and mm-hmm. she was a decent physical match for the original actress. I just thought it was funny that you look at Bindi Irwin's filmography and then randomly it's like Nim's Island 2.
Well, I used to religiously watch Bindi the Jungle Girl on Discovery Kids, which was my favorite channel as a kid. And, yes. You know, as productive as this tangent has been, I'm going to get us back on track. So we then see Bobby at work is talking with May on the phone. And mm-hmm. May is worried because Athena is like right in the danger zone. But Bobby assures her that Athena is where she wants to be, right, doing her job. May mm-hmm. suddenly on her computer at work notices a like motion detected signal on the map. Like, I guess they've got this map of what, like, sort of whatever kind of sensors detect, like, earthquakes and stuff. There's been motion detected in the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah. And Athena is busy connecting with this lady. They're sort of relating to each other in a sense because Athena, you know, she's talking about how, like, you know, she lied to her husband about, like, you know, how, you know, she was, you know, et cetera. She left out that, like, it took everything in her will to get out of bed and put on the badge and go to work because of trauma. And this lady seemingly has some sort of trauma that is related in some way, so she can connect with Athena. And so Athena begins to because they're lying to themselves. You know, it's this whole performance. Like, she talks about how, you know, every day she wakes up and she puts on her makeup and she gets all dressed up and just sort of in the hope that one day she'll sort of get back in the game of like stepping outside. And Athena says, well, you know, you still do all of this. You know, you're still in the game. Just don't count yourself out just yet, diva. And and so they go to step outside. Oh, but she just can't do it. She just can't. Mm-hmm. If I take one more step, Mr. Frodo, I'll be farthest from home I've ever been. The seismograph goes wild. Oh, y'all, it's gonna be Hollywood. It's gonna be for my BoJack viewers out there. It's gonna be Hollywood out here, okay? Because the sign is coming down.
This is like the greatest. I think this is such a great end to the episode. Such an iconic end of a 911 season premiere. Because yes, they pull up a feed basically at the dispatch. They pull up like a camera feed of the Hollywood Hills, and they see that the Hollywood sign is moving. It's like trembling. Athena, at the house, Athena walks outside.
Hollywood's
she tells Sylvia,
"It's a ghost town."
She tells Sylvia, "She's got this." Sylvia, can't bring herself to step out of the house, so she like goes back inside right as the ground starts to give way, and Athena, bold, you know, tenacious person that she is, she jumps into the house after her, very dramatic, and the house just like goes down in the landslide, and we get a
the landslide
truly incredible,
literally brings them down
brings them down. We get a truly incredible final shot of the Hollywood sign crumbling in the mudslide, and you know, end scene. I thought this was fantastic.
Incredible. A great spectacle. And also, I will say, very very prescient for you know, the next few years in LA, the current state of the Hollywood film industry, because y'all know it's crumbling, right? Y'all know it's going down. It's a bad time to be in film.
You know where you guys should all be moving if you're interested in getting into the film industry? Wisconsin. Because my cousin mm-hmm. Nathan just successfully lobbied for like a long time to get Wisconsin to introduce a film tax credit, essentially. So it is now a lot more financially viable to make a film in Wisconsin. I actually just joined him on set. He's making a movie called Winter Hymns, a feature that was all shot in Wisconsin with local talent. Very cool thing. I don't know when it'll be out, but I'll let you know.
Everyone,
it's about palliative
say thank
care.
You. to Jane's cousin Nathan for all of the wonderful work that he is doing for the film industry in the Midwest. Doing the Lord's work, sir. I look forward to the release of your film.
They hardly ever get tsunamis in Wisconsin.
That's true. That's true. Do you guys get twisters up north?
I think yes. It's pretty rare in the cities. Like I, as a kid, when I kind of learned that tornadoes happened, I became very, very afraid of tornadoes. And that, you know, we have like a warning system, like they do the siren, they test the sirens every first Wednesday of the month. But I have never, there have been like tornado watches. I've never experienced a tornado in the cities. They probably happen in rural areas. But yeah,
I mean, that's such a kid thing to be afraid of.
I remember tornadoes are such a big problem for me.
Like, I remember when I was a kid. And I was so terrified by and fascinated with hurricanes. Mm-hmm. Like, guys, I don't know how to explain to you that I grew up in Seattle and the Seattle area. There has never been a hurricane in Washington State in recorded history, as far as I'm aware.
Although season 25 of Grey's Anatomy, they're probably going to find a way to make it happen.
Hello. Hello. What's that promo that they just dropped for the new season that everyone was clowning on as well?
It almost looks like it's connected to the 911 promo because you've got like some, I don't know, like a comet or something like crashes into the hospital. You can't really tell what it is from the promo. But I will be
seated. They need to declare a fucking state of emergency at that hospital and in LA just at all times because of this.
Like, maybe let's just evacuate the entire city. Like, no one should be living
TV
here in the Grays and 911 universes.
Is terrorizing the West Coast. Is terrorizing the West Coast. Everyone needs to move inland. Oh, speaking of moving inland from LA, another place that's popping off in the film industry right now is New Mexico. So if you're looking to get into the film industry, New Mexico is the place to be as well. The Santa Fe area. So,
Yeah, Georgia's always maybe, a big
no,
one.
No, the Albuquerque area, I think. Not the Santa Fe, the Albuquerque area. Yeah, Georgia's huge. And then Europe. It's Europe.
Canada as well. Toronto, I think maybe Vancouver, Alberta, those kinds of places.
Guys, if enough of us move to Toronto, we can make the Degrassi reboot happen.
And we can do it however we want. Anyway, I don't know why we've like stopped talking about the episode so quickly after we finished it, but I overall thought this one was pretty good. And again, think the ending is like one of the strongest premiere hooks of the entire show. It's just so like everything I love about 911 camp. The only thing I'd say about this episode is it does feel a little utilitarian overall, where like what I mean by that is like, you know, we have some fun emergency stuff like with the bus in the building, but a lot of the scenes in this episode I felt were like largely expository to kind of like catch us up with COVID being a thing in the 911 world and like how that's been affecting all of our characters, which like you said, in like the Maddie and Chimney scene, like it is fun and interesting to see how it's affected their lives, but we're not really delving into a lot of the character stuff yet. Only a little bit with like Athena. A lot of our characters were kind of just like fun and games in this episode, which I don't mind, but I wonder if maybe the second episode will actually be more fun in terms of like disaster and character stuff. This one felt like kind of doing a lot of legwork to get us caught up.
Because you understand why they did that, right? Because it is like a lot of ground to establish because of like, it's very necessary given the absolute tailspin the world was sent into in March of 2020. And the months that, you know, immediately followed that sort of 6 month period. So it makes sense why they would do that. But no, I totally get that, like sort of missing out on what was so great about, say, the season 3 tsunami arc. Right. Or the even like the,
said,
yeah, the season 2 earthquake arc as well. To maybe
I mean,
like
both
a slightly
of those seasons,
extent.
Like the disaster doesn't really start until the end of the first episode. So it does make sense.
Also true.
But like in the season 3 premiere, we definitely were getting a lot of character stuff accomplished, like with Buck in particular. I don't think that makes this episode bad. Like it's kind of a special situation where they had to, get like do extra exposition to get the COVID stuff established. So, yeah, I forgive them.
Maybe that's the special formula because this was a very Buck light episode. It was a very Buckley episode, wasn't it?
Need to stop doing Buck storylines?
No, no. What I'm saying is, like, the formula for, like, sort of balancing that is to make it sort of very Buck-centric in the first episode. Or the first opening disaster. Because, we didn't get a lot of Buck this episode. And I was kind of missing that. I was missing my boy. But maybe we'll get more of him next time. Although, given that I can't remember a single thing about his character in this opening arc, I'm not confident.
They might have been saving it because there's some big Buck stuff later in the season, you know?
Yeah, that's definitely true. And, like, especially, like at the tail end of it, the closest we've ever been to Buddy Cannon outside of, like, season 8 pining, yearning era was the ending of season 4. Not to, you know, spoil anything, but to hype people up.
Yeah, that's another reason to be excited about this season. This is a very buddy season, in my opinion.
I agree. I'm looking forward to talking about it. So with that, thank you guys for listening. Thank you for tuning into this episode of the First Reach Podcast. We're starting season 4, getting back to our regular upload schedule after a little break. If you want to support us, you can follow us on social media at First Reach Podcast, spelled how it sounds, of course. And if you'd like to support us further, you can join our Patreon. We'll be putting out this month's winning topic sometime soon, which is oh god oh god,
it's a fandom autopsy which I don't even really know what that entails. I think we're just gonna kind of go over, like, iconic fandom events, pet peeves, drama, etc. All sorts of things, probably.
And we won't piss anyone off in the process.
No, it'll be so non-controversial, I'm sure. So check that out.
Thank you guys for listening. And just remember, you know, if that wave is coming down on you, just keep biking. Keep biking.
And just breathe. But you know what I was thinking about when the Hollywood sign came down is...
What's
do
that?
You remember the movie The Kissing Booth?
yes.
One of my favorites. In that movie, Joey King and Jacob Elordi, well, they're characters, they actually, like, have sex at the Hollywood sign, which I'm not sure that's a thing you can do, but they did it in the movie. And I was just kind of imagining, like, imagine kind of bringing those two narratives together. And, like, you know, Elle and Noah are in the process of getting it on the Hollywood sign when suddenly the entire Hollywood sign and the entire, you know, expanse of the Hollywood Hills just kind of mudslides on top of them, killing them instantly. Would it improve the movie? Maybe.
That would have maybe made it less of a sour note in Jacob Elordi's mouth, because as we know, he's not a fan of those films. I think he shaded them on a red carpet, you know, within
the
last
2 years. He did, and that's
interesting,
because I would actually call that film the apex of his career so far, but I guess he and I just don't see eye to eye.
Hey, maybe Emerald Fennell's Wuthering Heights will turn that around.
It's actually going to be like a meta spiritual sequel to The Kissing Booth.
God forbid. Oh, God help us.